want them to understand that that saving Eielson and keeping F-16s here is important to the community.
Fairbanks gears up for a hearing on the Air Force plan to move the F-16s to Anchorage. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, February 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Hugh Neff leads the Yukon Quest, but Alan Moore isn't far behind.
Can't let Hugh dictate what I'm doing because he's running forever without any rest. Usually that bites you in the butt in the end.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're interested in serving on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council, the deadline to apply is Monday, February 18. The councils provide information to the Federal Subsistence Board on subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing. For more information on the advisory councils and how to apply, call 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Senator Mark Begich is introducing a bill that would grant the state a share of revenues from offshore drilling. APRN's Peter Granitz reports.
The concept is nothing new. The Alaska delegation has long sought the chance to reap royalty payments from oil producers drilling off Alaska's shore. Senator Begich's bill would grant the state 37.5% of the royalty bids. Right now, the federal government collects the entire sum. He says the state needs to be rewarded for assuming some of the liability.
We know already after this first season, and really season and a half, of exploratory in the Arctic, there is impact. Housing costs have gone up. Water and sewer is reaching capacity in some of the communities along the coast because of so many new people there. There's a lot of impact, and we get not one penny from Outer Continental Shelf development.
Of the money the state would collect, 40% would go to the state, 25% to local governments, another quarter to Alaska Native corporations, and 10% directly to tribes. The numbers vary from past revenue-sharing bills, but Senator Begich says he's willing to change numbers to assure the delegation presents one plan. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The Air Force is beginning a series of public meetings on its proposal to move an F-16 squadron from Eielson Air Force Base in North Pole to Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. Meetings are scheduled for tonight and tomorrow in Anchorage and Palmer, and in Fairbanks and North Pole Wednesday and Thursday. As KUAC's Dan Ross reports, Fairbanks is rallying to protect the local Air Force installation from downsizing.
Fairbanks North Star Borough Mayor Luke Hopkins hung a red America Needs Eielson t-shirt over the podium when he addressed the Chamber of Commerce last week about the upcoming Air Force meetings. Hopkins urged members to provide substantive input.
Not just opinions that are given that we shouldn't move them, but what we need to do is we need to give the Air Force specific issues to look at, to analyze relative to how we, our community, and other areas of the state see this F-16 move so that the Air Force looks at all angles, not just the ones that they think are important on their pieces of paper.
Hopkins said a number of community leaders will have specific messages related to impacts of the F-16 move on housing, school enrollment, and the local economy. The Air Force is taking public input as part of the scoping process for development of an environmental impact statement on the proposal. It calls for relocating 21 jets and over 1,500 personnel, primarily active duty, from Fairbanks to Anchorage as a cost-saving measure. Former Borough Assembly member Nadine Winters is coordinating the community response for the Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation. Winters says the scoping meetings will set parameters for the EIS, but are also a general opportunity to show how much the community cares about Eielson.
We want them to understand that saving Eielson and keeping F-16s here is important to the community. So people can testify if they feel comfortable, but by no means is that a requirement. That just people's presence, I think, is going to send a strong message.
Winters credits a big local turnout at a base realignment and closure commission hearing in Fairbanks with saving Eielson back in 2005. The recently passed National Defense Authorization Act includes a provision inserted by Alaska's congressional delegation delaying any actual movement of aircraft or people from Eielson to Jay Bear until 2014. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
An explosion rocked a Fairbanks neighborhood over the weekend. Alaska State Troopers say the blast occurred on a makeshift shooting range on private property in the Chena Ridge area on Saturday afternoon. Trooper spokeswoman Meg Peters says no injuries were reported, but there was damage to area homes.
People said that there was a big boom in the area. There was some damage to homes. Windows busted out, things falling over. Troopers were able to locate the location of where we believe the boom started and originated from, but it's under investigation as to the circumstances surrounding it and what actually caused it.
Troopers say at least a dozen residences were affected by the explosion, with at least half reporting structural damage, including blown-out windows and soffit vents. Troopers are being assisted in the investigation by the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Hugh Neff is leading the Yukon Quest. He left the Stepping Stone Hospitality Checkpoint at 9:47 this morning. Two Rivers musher Alan Moore followed at 11:25. Brent Sass, Jake Berkowitz, and Scott Smith round out the top five. Over the weekend, the trail was shortened by 50 miles to eliminate the climb over American Summit, which is too icy, according to race marshal Doug Grillett.
You know how you get snow gets that scoured where you can't even put a boot to it? I mean, I'm visualizing that at the steep, you know, 45-degree angles.
Teams still have more than 600 miles to travel before they get there. And as KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, the competition will be stiff along the way.
Everyone's curious about 2012 Yukon Quest champion Hugh Neff's race strategy. He trains dogs specifically to run 1,000-mile races, so his run-rest schedule is different compared with teams that also run in mid-distance races. By the time Neff pulled into CarMax, 177 miles down the trail, he had only rested for 4 hours. Neff says he's trying to keep his distance from the competition.
One thing I've learned through the years is if you start following other mushers around, you know what they end up doing? They start messing with you. And that's why I'm avoiding my buddy Lance and my buddy Alan and everybody else. We might camp together sooner or later, but you know what? When it comes down to it, this is a race, and we all got to do our own thing.
Neff only briefly relinquished his lead to Alan Moore at the McCabe Creek Dog Drop. It's roughly 40 miles outside of CarMax. He says it's all part of his plan.
No, it'll be fun for my leaders, you know. I think they're getting bored up there a little bit.
Two-time Quest finisher Alan Moore isn't swayed by other mushers' decisions.
You know, I can't let Hugh dictate what I'm doing because he's running forever without any rest. Usually that bites you in the butt in the end. And if he keeps doing it, I'd bet a lot of money that bites him in the butt again.
Based on his run-rest pattern, Moore's arrival in Pelly Crossing was so predictable, it was clear he was also keeping very close track of his time.
If I what?
Set a timer for your run-rest.
Absolutely. My ding-dinging was going off just a second ago. I'm just kidding you.
No, you don't?
I don't.
Consistency may also explain why Moore's dogs were jumping in harness when they pulled the Two Rivers musher into the race's third checkpoint. Brent Sass is known for running and resting his team consistently. He likes to run 50 to 60 miles and then rest for roughly 4 hours. He says he'll stick to that for the first half of the race, regardless of the competition.
I'm blocking it completely out. Like, if you start chasing Hugh Neff right now, I know that I would be getting myself into trouble. So I'm trying to completely forget about my competitors at this point, get a real healthy dog team into Dawson, and go from there.
Jake Berkowitz is also following a consistent run-rest schedule. He blew through CarMax so fast, his wife Robin had to answer for him as his team of energetic dogs nearly jumped out of their harnesses before they sped away.
Is that the plan?
That's the plan so far. Yes. That's all I can tell you. He's right on schedule.
Four-time Quest champion Lance Mackey hasn't been able to pull together consistent runs. He has a few dehydrated dogs who've taken to dipping for mouthfuls of snow on their way down the trail.
I don't think the dipping would be so bad if it wasn't the acrobatics that come with it. They're jerking each other all over the place, off their feet, in the ditches, just back and forth. I think some of them are injuring one another just by doing that.
Mackey was visibly disappointed in CarMax. The more he has to stop and rest his dogs, the farther away his competition runs.
Alan is probably going to have to fall in a hole in the Yukon to get caught.
A good musher never divulges their complete race plan, but most of them seem to think running steady could win this year's race, and they're all biding their time until they reach the halfway mark in Dawson City. From the Yukon Quest Trail in Pelly Crossing, I'm Emily Schwing.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, school counselors in Anchorage talk about preventing suicide.
It begins with building social and emotional skills. These are the skills that kids need to be successful in life.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority was created by the Alaska State Legislature to develop, stimulate, and advance the economic welfare of the state and further the development of public transportation systems. The authority has completed required environmental work to date, and the Federal Highway Administration has given its approval needed to move forward. There's more information at KinnickArmBridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Arguments will be heard this week in Federal District Court in Anchorage regarding wetlands permits for the Port McKenzie rail spur. The environmental group Cook Inlet Keeper has filed suit in an attempt to block the link between the port and Houston. The Matanuska Susitna Borough is behind the rail spur project, although the Federal Surface Transportation Board must approve it. Bob Shavelson is a spokesman for Cook Inlet Keeper.
This is essentially going to be a 32-mile fill across the Big Lake wetlands complex, and it's going to have an enormous impact on salmon in the Natsu Valley. The former fish and game biologist described it as a 32-mile-long dam.
But Patty Sullivan, speaking for the borough, says a court decision late last year has upheld the STB's determination on need for the rail spur and its approval of the project's environmental studies. Those decisions could influence the outcome of the latest suit.
This is challenging a U.S. Army Corps permit and the approval of that permit for the rail project. We find hope in the Ninth Circuit's conclusion, which says there was a thoughtful, detailed, thorough analysis of the wetlands.
The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in November ruled in favor of the railroad project. At that time, the court reversed an earlier decision by a three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit halting construction on the spur line. The northern fur seals that breed on the Pribilof Islands have been on the decline for decades. A smaller colony just 200 miles away is thriving. As KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, a new study of these colonies is challenging scientists' assumptions about what marine animals need from their environment and how they get it.
The National Marine Mammal Laboratory sends a team to the Pribilofs every 2 years to count new northern fur seal pups. Since 1998, the overall production of pups has dropped by 45%. But according to the latest count, the Pribilof fur seals bucked the downward trend for the first time in 15 years. Rod Tall is a statistician from the Mammal Lab. He says pup production increased a tiny amount in 2012, just 0.5%. And while that's not statistically significant, Tall says that the data is promising.
In my estimation, it's a good sign in the sense that it didn't decline again.
Meanwhile, on Bogoslav Island, it's a different story. Pup populations have increased every year since the first pup was spotted there in 1980. A group of researchers has been studying why this island's on the rise while the Pribilofs are in decline. Andrew Trites is a fisheries professor at the University of British Columbia. He was on the team to study the animals' diets for clues.
And it was to really understand how top predators, seabirds, and fur seals interact with the environment. How do they find their prey? What drives their numbers to increase? What causes them to decline?
One of the biggest issues is how they eat. The northern fur seals, black-legged kittiwakes, and thick-billed murres that the group studied all have to make trade-offs between the energy they spend to reach their prey and the energy they get from that food source. Until recently, scientists weren't sure how the animals judge that trade-off. Contrary to what they expected, Trites and his fellow researchers found that the seabirds and fur seals don't go to areas with the highest biomass of prey, or even the highest number of prey. That information is what fish management decisions are based on, but the fur seals and seabirds don't behave like resource managers. Instead, they behave a little more like fishermen. Just like trawlers searching for schools of fish, the fur seals and birds go to patches, areas where there's a dense school of fish or krill, and eat there. Those patches change often, depending on a slew of conditions that affect the prey's behavior, and the researchers don't yet understand why the animals use them. In a presentation at the Marine Science Symposium in Anchorage, Trites went over his piece of the research, which compared Pribilof foragers to Boguslaw foragers.
Primarily the MERS and the fur seals on the Pribilofs, where they're declining or have declined, they really eat a lot of pollock. And we discovered down at Boguslaw, they're not eating pollock. They're eating mostly squid and northern smooth tongue, or these deep water fishes that are high in energy. So a big difference in diet.
Trites thinks that the Pribilof seals are declining because they're eating juvenile pollock, which he says don't have enough energy. He says the group's research shows that in order for populations to recover, the ecosystem around the islands would have to shift.
You can see that under the right feeding conditions, if you've got high energy prey near these islands, they can do extremely well and rebound. And hopefully we'll see that return too one day to the Pribilofs.
The results of the Bering Sea study were published in January in the journal PLOS ONE. And on Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
An environmental research program with a long history of working in Alaska is breaking new ground by partnering with state universities to find out why an area in the Chukchi Sea is so biologically productive. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes has this report.
Hannah Shoal is a 30-mile stretch of shallow water located about 90 miles offshore of Point Barrow and 25 miles north of the Shell Oil drill site in the Chukchi Sea. At the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, or BOEM, anthropologist Dr. D. Williams is chief of the Environmental Studies Program. He says the goal of the Hannah Shoal project, as with other BOEM studies, is to help ensure that science is part of the mix during decision-making about oil and gas development.
Biologically productive areas may be deferred from future leases as one option that the agency would have, or there may be mitigation measures that would be in place on future lease conditions.
University of Texas Marine Science Institute Professor Dr. Ken Denton leads the team of experts in physics, chemistry, ecology, and biology from 8 state universities working on the Hannah Shoal project.
It's an area that's very important ecologically because there's a lot of walrus that frequent the area that are feeding and they are on the ice, using the ice as a platform for feeding and resting. And to the east of the Hannah Shoal area is also a gray whale feeding area as well.
Dr. Denton says the team has already gained new information from its first field season, a 3-week expedition to Hannah Shoal in 2012. He says one reason the area is so productive is that ocean currents converge there, bringing nutrients. Those feed microscopic plants and animals, or phytoplankton and zooplankton, and copepods, animals less than a tenth of an inch in size. Dr. Denton says warmer temperatures have led to thinner sea ice, allowing more light to reach ice algae.
And they become very, very productive. They turn the ice yellow, greenish colors, and a lot of that production is those diatoms are important food for crustaceans and copepods, zooplankton. And those zooplankton, those crustaceans are, of course, food for fish. And fish are food for seals and so on. So the this extra, if you want to call it a food subsidy, in the form of ice algae, may be responsible for making the area seasonally more productive than we have thought.
Dr. Denton has been involved in polar studies since the 1980s. He says changes in the Arctic are prompting increased research by a wide range of scientists.
It's a very exciting time to be in the Arctic, exciting time for scientists to be working on some of the big questions that we've been trying to answer for decades. And it's an excellent group of teams from various organizations that are working together, and that's very exciting for all of us.
BOEM has about 30 studies underway in Alaska, in the Beaufort Sea and Cook Inlet regions, as well as the Chukchi Sea. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by The 2013 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. If you're interested in serving on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council, the deadline to apply is Monday, February 18th. Email subsistence@fws.gov for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
There have been at least two suicides in Anchorage schools over the past 3 weeks and an attempted suicide by a student who had dropped out. Death from suicide is a loss that school counselors work hard to prevent. Heather Coulihan is a social and emotional learning specialist, and Eric Visti is a coordinator within the Special Education Department of ASD. I sat down with them to ask how suicide prevention is being addressed within Anchorage schools. Visti says when a suicide happens, everyone who will be affected needs to be identified.
You want to look at all the different factors and identify who are those survivors and examine the different proximity elements. You want to understand the event. You want to understand who was emotionally close to the student, who was physically close to the student. If you have someone in a upper grade level, looking back and looking at the elementary grade levels, middle schools, you know, so on and so forth. In general, I mean, I think you want to be very factual. You want to stick with the facts of what you know and what is known. You also want to be very aware of today's current technology. I mean, there's social media. There's a lot of information out there, and information goes out very fast today.
I know that there's concern about talking about it and drawing attention to suicide, that that's been a concern expressed, especially in smaller communities where there's worry that if it's discussed too much, it may prompt other kids who are feeling vulnerable to attempt suicide. But of course, it has to be discussed so that young people can recognize the signs within themselves if they're at risk or danger, and also in others. So how do you balance those two things to get the word out without sort of glamorizing it, for lack of a better term?
Well, one thing that we have found with our social and emotional learning standards that we have in the school district, it is a way for kids in their daily context, in their daily lives at schools, to develop skills to talk about emotions with other students, with adults. They're developing skills to manage their emotions. So it becomes an ordinary thing to be able to talk about feelings and emotions and setting goals and good listening with other people and using good conflict resolution skills. So it becomes a natural part of how students and adults are interacting with each other. So when something difficult comes up, when a challenge comes up, kids have the skills to talk about it.
And one thing that we've done this year, there was a state law that was passed regarding suicide awareness and prevention, and we implemented a professional development for teachers, staff members, and buildings on suicide awareness and prevention. And I know we had training that was taking place this last fall on suicide awareness and prevention that was provided through the Jason Foundation.
How about the parents? What do you hear from them? Do they want more or less conversation in school about the dangers of being at risk for suicide?
What I'm hearing, especially more recently, is how do we talk with my son or daughter? You know, if you've had a suicide and your child is impacted by the loss of one of their friends, you know, how do I support that person? What kind of things do I need to be looking for? There might be some impact in terms of some academic decline or some truancy or some absenteeism. Well, how do I find the connection? How do I find the supports? And then also just understanding that from a grief perspective, no two people grieve the same. I mean, different people, different culture, different religious beliefs have different, and it all influences people's grieving. And the circumstances surrounding the event and the response to that also can help influence that.
If you were going to give just some quick advice to parents, to students, to people who care about students, what would you want them to know they can do immediately to try to help prevent these tragedies?
Well, I think it really begins with prevention, and it begins with building social and emotional skills in kids. These are the skills that kids need to be successful in life in general, and to be successful in their school life, to be successful in relationships. And they're the skills that then help kids have the skills to help their friends, to help themselves when difficult things come up. And these are skills that we can all work towards building in kids, whatever our role is in a child's life. We can all, because they're skills, they can be learned. They can be built through specific activities, through specific experiences, chances to practice. So that would be my advice, is to build those skills early. And then kids can have that foundation to build on when tragedy and hard times come.
There's cuts coming down for the Anchorage School District. How will those cuts impact the ability to have ready counselors to talk to kids at times like this, when there's been a couple of suicides within the school district, and maybe there needs to be sort of a heightened awareness of watching kids in those schools?
I couldn't tell you specifically about how it's going to impact the ability. I can tell you what we're going to continue to do. We're going to continue to be responsive to the needs of all of our buildings, to all of our students and all of our staff. If there's another event, we have crisis teams that are in place that we can deploy. There are professionals that volunteer and they want to be on this, and we'll call them at 10 p.m., 6 a.m., and say, hey, we've got a need. We need you to come over and help out with a certain building with a certain situation. And people are very interested in helping out and going above and beyond what's expected of them sometimes. So I think we're going to continue to be able to do that. And be responsive to the needs for all of our students.
Heather Coulihan and Eric Visti work for the Anchorage School District. Links to resources are at our website, alaskapublic.org. And finally tonight, a correction in our story Friday on the Shinonoe cargo ship. We said it was originally bound for Prince William Sound. In fact, it was headed for Prince Rupert, British Columbia. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Emily Schwing on the Yukon Quest Trail, Ellen Lockyer and Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, and Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. Regardless of where you live, you've got a better shot at earning the Alaska Performance Scholarship by enrolling in the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. ANSEP challenges students with classes that are necessary to earn the scholarship. ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.